Should we modify physician heal thyself to physician stay home and don't give the rest of us anything?
How long should you take blood thinners after you've had a blood clot to the lung?
Can we dispense with allergy shots?
And a surprising trajectory of cognitive decline after a stroke.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on July 10th, 2015, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Science System in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I would like to start with the one where I said, should we change to physicians stay home when you're sick? That's a study that takes a look at, hey, who's coming to work when they're sick, even though they know everyone else should stay home when they're sick. That's in JAMA Pediatrics.
Elizabeth, I thought this was a pretty interesting study, partly because it was a self-indictment. We know that we spend a lot of time trying to prevent transmission of infectious diseases. For example, we talk a lot about using barriers like gloves or gowns and hand washing. But we sometimes forget that sometimes healthcare workers who are ill are also able to transmit disease, especially to patients, if they end up taking care of them after they've developed an illness. So what this study attempted to do was find out how many healthcare providers report they actually continue to see patients after they've been sick. How often does that happen, and what are the reasons for that? To do that, they surveyed a number of physicians and non-physician healthcare providers at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Almost 1,000 different healthcare workers were surveyed. What they discovered was that although 95% of the healthcare workers surveyed believe that working while sick put patients at risk, nevertheless, 83% reported still doing it. They had done it at least one time in the past year. 1 in 5 had done it 2 to 4 times, and 1 in 11 had done it more than 5 times. And then they asked them, well, why did you do that? The primary reasons they cited included not wanting to let their colleagues down or their patients down, logistic problems in finding coverage, a strong cultural norm to work through sickness, and then finally, even some ambiguity about what constitutes sickness. For example, 1/3 of them said, if I had diarrhea, I would still go to work.
Well, this doesn't sound too good with regard to transmission risk, because while adults, as we know, are normally not terribly infectious after they've finished with the symptomatology, that's not true for all infections. And what about the prodrome? That's the time when things are really bad.
And remember that the patients we're often taking care of are immunocompromised, or in the case of pediatricians, they're actually neonates, and these individuals are particularly at risk. So it forces us to take a step back and say, okay, guys, if we're going to do what's right for the patients, we have to have different processes and plan differently so that when we become sick, we can get coverage. For example, this already happens for residents. There are residents that are, quote, at jeopardy. That means if one of their colleagues reports sick, they take over that colleague's work. We need to have some flexibility so that if a healthcare worker is sick, they can pick up the phone and call and say, listen, I'm not a wimp. I'm not trying to get out of work, but I'm sick and I shouldn't put patients at risk.
I'm starting to wonder about things like, as you remember, when Ebola was fulminant, this idea that somehow screening could be done without someone's knowledge. So I'm thinking, wow, what if there is something as you made your way into the hospital that assessed your body temperature, for example?
Well, many of these illnesses don't present with a high enough body temperature.
Okay. Occult screening isn't going to work, but what else can we do? Change the norm.
I think we need to change the norm and change the expectations. And Elizabeth, as you mentioned, people are oftentimes infectious, not only when they're at the highest symptom level, but even at the prodrome level as well. It's going to take a cultural change.
Okay. Speaking of cultural change, this is something else that really is a cultural change. Can we avoid allergy shots by using allergens that are placed under the tongue? That's known as sublingual therapy. That's in JAMA Internal Medicine.
There have been several studies that have looked at the efficacy of sublingual immunotherapy. Immunotherapy previously was administered by giving injections. So you would come to the physician's office perhaps weekly or biweekly. The thought being is if you could expose people to increasing amounts of the allergen, it would be an effective treatment for their allergic condition. This particular study is a systematic review and a meta-analysis looking at the efficacy of sublingual immunotherapy specifically directed towards one of the more common allergens, grass pollen allergen. Although they had previously examined it, there have been several new trials Many were conducted in the U.S. where the previous trials were actually conducted in Europe. So they looked at randomized clinical trials that compared grass pollen sublingual therapy that had already been approved both in the European Union and the United States and compared them to placebo. And what they discovered overall was that there was a very small benefit of the grass pollen sublingual tablets in both reducing symptoms and decreasing the use of medication to combat the symptoms. These authors weren't convinced that the results were sufficiently good to actually warrant their use.
That's very disappointing, isn't it? Because I know many people, especially parents, have high hopes for sublingual immunotherapy because, gosh, getting your kid to sign up for shots every week or even less often than that isn't an easy task.
No, and the other thing that was a little bit interesting about this particular meta-analysis, even though the results with sublingual therapy seemed to be fairly unimpressive, the effectiveness was even smaller in the United States compared with the European populations. It looked very promising, but in this systematic review and in this meta-analysis, very modest benefits.
I guess we need to compare that, of course, against the traditional injection model and what the benefits of that are.
Most of these trials didn't compare sublingual therapy to injection therapy. It's hard to do that in a blinded way.
Back to the drawing board, maybe. We'll see what happens. Let's turn from here then to the idea that cognitive decline after stroke, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, an ongoing problem.
This is a huge issue because the lifetime risk for stroke is approximately 1 in 5 for women and 1 in 6 for men. That means across the U.S., about 800,000 Americans experience a stroke each year. We have over 7 million adult stroke survivors currently. The stroke typically involves motor, sensory, or other deficits and may or may not have a significant degree of cognitive impairment. This was a study in which over 23,000 individuals had an assessment of their cognitive function as a part of a national study. These are people that had not had stroke and had not had cognitive decline, but they had cognitive assessment, and it was done serially. About 2% or 512 individuals total experienced a stroke. And not surprisingly, what they found is with the stroke, there was an acute decline in cognitive function. And among the general population, there was a slow decline in cognitive function. The interesting thing with the stroke survivors was that decline persisted and accelerated compared to the general population over the next 6 to 7 years, in the absence, by the way, of repeated strokes.
Something that, of course, is really important to get our arms around. What happens? What's the long-term impact of this?
And that's what the authors mentioned, is that this doesn't get to the mechanism. Is it because of other comorbid conditions, diabetes or hypertension? The general population has those as well. Is this an ongoing immune problem as a result of the stroke? Or does the neurodegeneration actually contribute to the cognitive decline? And by the way, the cognitive decline was centered in certain areas. There was a faster decline in global recognition or global cognition and a faster decline in executive function, for example. What the authors recommend is that not only are we treating the acute stroke, but now we need to look at new therapies that prevent the more rapid decline in cognitive function that happens over the next 6 to 7 years.
Clearly, we need to figure out why that happens so that we can hopefully develop some kind of effective intervention. Finally, then, let's turn to something we seem to be talking about a lot, and that's blood clot formation, in this case, pulmonary embolism, also in the Journal of the American Medical Association. What about extended anticoagulation after such an event?
Well, I almost hesitated to talk about this because we recently talked about the fact that if you have an unprovoked pulmonary embolism or clot to the lung, is that you shouldn't be doing CT scans looking for cancer. There are other better screening devices. This report comes on the heels of that. In individuals that have an unprovoked pulmonary embolism, that is, there's no underlying risk factors, how long should they be on anticoagulation? Routinely, they're on it for 3 to 6 months because during that time period, they're at risk of having a recurrent clot. But this study asks the question, well, should we continue it for an additional 18 months. It took 371 adults with an unprovoked pulmonary embolism, treated them all for 6 months. Half of them, they continued that therapy for another 18 months. It may not be surprising to know that in those individuals that had their anticoagulation continued, there was a decline in the risk of recurrent embolism. It reduced it by about 80%, by the way. It did increase the risk of bleeding. Here's the interesting thing, though. When they stopped it after 18 months and followed them for the next 6 months, the risk of recurrence went back up. So at the end of the 24 months, there was no difference between those that continued for 18 months and those continued to 6 months.
All right. And so does that suggest to you that anticoagulation needs to be maintained in these folks once they've had an unprovoked pulmonary embolism?
Well, in fact, that's what it suggests to me, Elizabeth. And that would particularly be true for individuals that are at low risk for having a bleeding complication. You might follow up and say, well, how much longer do you need it? And unfortunately, no studies address that.
And I would also follow up by saying, and who is at low risk?
Those would be individuals that have not had a previous bleeding episode, don't have high blood pressure, that are relatively young.
Okay. On that note, I'll reveal that I'm going to do the sublingual immunotherapy this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.